following programming is sponsored by 6 Feet Over Under Productions. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by Elec 825. We are thrilled to join you on WWDB 860 AM, part of the Beasley Media Group, ready to help you move into the weekend, talking about all the news in the world of sports. Jeff, I'm going to throw it right to you.
Why?
Are you buying what the Phillies are selling?
What, that they might, that they're selling playoff tickets now?
Absolutely.
Well, they are selling hope. I don't know if I have that kind of hope, but look, the Phillies have, from what I understand, the Phillies have not made the playoffs in a decade and are the have the longest drought in the National League.
Okay.
Yes, I want to believe that it's coming to an end.
Okay. But
there's moments in almost every game, even during the 6-game win streak, where I'm sitting there going, this bubble's about to burst, that it can't last as long. You lost Rhys Hoskins for the season. Aaron Nola doesn't look like your fourth best pitcher right now. I mean, Nola's not pitching this weekend, and I'm going, good. So you have Gibson, who's got a below 3 ERA, Ranger Suarez, who's got a below 2 ERA, and then Wheeler on Sunday. Those are your three best pitchers right now.
And yet they're 69-64, mm-hmm. with 29 games remaining in the season. They've won 6 in a row. They didn't have a single win streak of 6 games or more in 2019 or 2020.
Yep.
They scored 7 runs or more in 7 straight games and have an 11-game win streak.
For the first time in 88 years.
Yes. Yeah. And an 11-game win streak against the NL East, and are now 2 games back of the Braves after sweeping the Nationals, heading into a weekend series against the Marlins, where Kyle Gibson, as you mentioned, Ranger, and Zach Wheeler will be on the mound.
And is there any single human being that isn't sitting there going, they're going in to face the Marlins and they're going to lose 2 or 3?
Well, that's definitely the thought.
See, that's the problem. Is that you, Jeff. The sky is falling. It is that constant feeling now of this group of Phillies because of the bullpen, because of the injuries. It just doesn't seem like it's in the cards. And they were out of it. You know, they had that fall 2 weeks ago. And then all of a sudden, now they're coming back and winning games. And it looks like they're doing it through smoke and mirrors. I mean, other than Bryce Harper, JT hasn't been playing consistently. The only person who's been playing consistently is Bryce Harper, who's not protected.
Gene Segura has played all right.
All right. But yeah, not consistently great.
Look, nobody on the team has been consistently great. And yet with guys like Nick Maton and Rafael Marchand, they're winning games right now. Can they keep that up that with 29 games left headed down the stretch? Do you believe? Okay.
I hope I don't believe. Cohen, how's that?
I believe the email said that you can reserve your seat for the first and second round of the playoffs, which is mm-hmm. funny, if you buy tickets for next season. But are right. you reserving your seat for the first and second round of the playoffs? Mind you, they're also only 2.5 games back in the wild card.
Yes, because I really? Hope. Yes, because I hope, but I don't believe. There are different words.
Okay, so it's the hopeful Jeff, not the realistic Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, I want to believe, as they say in the X-Files, but I know I just dated myself and half the people don't even know what the X-Files are. But
this is the, I haven't been out of my house in 10 days, but I'm feeling better and really want to leave my house, Jeff.
10 days? It's been 2 weeks, dude. I'm upright enough that I said it's okay for you to stream this. But
yeah, that ends up happening. We'll get back.
But that doesn't mean that my head is clear. So it's very possible what I'm saying to you right now may change once I become more lucid.
In fairness, when you think lucid, it still doesn't mean that you say good things. So let's just...
I'm not going to disagree with you.
We've got somebody on the line who could certainly break it all down and analyze how you're feeling and tell you how to feel about it.
Who might that be?
Well, why don't you bring him on and introduce our guest who we're going to have join us today and break down a little baseball and a little bit to the mental.
You just said that I'm not lucid, but I'll take a shot at who I think is on. I believe that Don Carmen, former Philly and current counselor of sports psychology to ball players, is that who we have on the line?
That would be correct.
Yes.
I just play the guessing game with Jeff. I don't really tell him what's going on. I just, you know, throw it to see what goes on with it. Don, thanks so much for giving a few minutes to join the show and talk about everything today.
Yeah, yeah, you got it. But no guessing games for me. I'm not good at them.
All right. Well,
that's the only one who gives pop quizzes.
So. Exactly. So okay. Don, we wanted to have you on because there's so much going on in the world of sports psychology, and I don't think it's ever been more important than it is now. But I did want to just start with a Philly story because I read it and I had never seen it before. And Jason and I have spent years interviewing the Phillies prospects as they come up and as they make it to the major leagues. And when I saw the story of your major league debut and your interaction with Darren Dalton, it really kind of touched me. And I was wondering if you could share it for our listeners, what that experience was and what Darren Dalton said to you.
I am on my very first game.
I believe it. What the story was is that you came out for your first major league save, I think.
Well, that was one where, I'd been up for 3 weeks because we were, okay. I'd been up for 3 weeks, but I had not pitched in any games because the Phillies, it was 83, they were in a pennant chase. And when we were in Chicago, they clinched it. And we had two games left. John Denny started one and won his 19th game, I think it was, and they weren't going to let me mess that one up. I think we had two more after that, and we were playing the Pirates, and they called down and said, you know, get Carmen up. And I thought it was just another day of, because it was 3-2 and going into the ninth inning. He said, get Carmen up, and I thought, yeah, they're just placating me like always. And I'm not going to the game with a save on the line. And so I get up and start flipping the ball. And then they call back and said, he's in. I couldn't breathe. I just absolutely froze right there. And so I'm actually going in. I'm in a 3-2 ball game. There are 48,000 people at the ballpark. It's just, and they're all screaming and yelling. It's so loud because everybody's so excited going into the playoffs. Right. And, so I warm up. I don't remember the rest of my warm up, but I remember jogging in from right field in Veterans Stadium. And I always jog in all the way to the mound, but I couldn't make it. I guess I wasn't breathing. I couldn't breathe. I stopped right by Juan Samuel at second base, and I bent over trying to catch my breath at second base. And Sammy started laughing at me because he knew it was very nerve wracking, and they brought Darren in at the same time, and he had been my catcher for years, and you know, and all summer he was my catcher in Double A, so he knew me really well, and so I'm standing, I walk up to the mound trying to catch my breath. I don't even remember what was said, whatever they handed me the ball. I don't remember my warm-up pitches at all. And I just remember standing on the mound and not moving and just frozen. I couldn't remember what to do. I was just standing there staring. I mean, it was in my stretch. And I was just staring at Dutch behind the plate. I remember saying to myself, I don't know what to do. And then I said, well, you can't just stand there. This is one of my thoughts, right? And the place was so loud. I remember feeling like the whole ground was shaking. And I realized later it was me that was shaking. And was standing on the mountain and said, well, you can't just stand here. You got to, well, I said, okay, well, just start moving and see what happens. That was my self-talk at that point. And I threw the first pitch, fastball down and away for strike one. And then threw the next one down and away, strike two, because that's where I lived in those days, down and away, right? So now I went from being scared to, I'm going to strike out the first batter I ever face. Like, it was, the light came on. It was that getting past that fear, that just, it wasn't just nervousness. This was like my freezing fear. And I wound up not striking him out, and I wound up getting the save. I had a, I think it was a 3-up and 3-down inning. I had an 0-2 count on all three hitters and got a save in my first outing. And it was comforting because I knew Darren knew me, and I didn't have to think about what pitches to throw. I just was going to do whatever he said, which was kind of what my whole career with him turned out to be. So our interactions were always him. He was just a leader. He was a great leader. And it was just so reassuring to know that you knew you not only had a good baseball man behind there, but a good person who understood people and what makes them go. What you may have been referring to was a game that I was down 4-0 in the first inning, and Bonds had just hit a double off the wall, and Darren Dalton was catching. It's when I was in the rotation, and 4-0, and I haven't gotten anybody out yet. And Dutch started ambling back toward the mound after getting another ball, and he wouldn't throw it. And I just kept thinking, throw the ball, would you please just throw the ball? So, because I'm so mad, you know, I can't even see. And he walked out to the mound, held the ball up over my glove, very slowly put it down into my glove. As he was doing it, he said, I don't know what you're doing out here, but it's not working. And he turned around and walked away, right? And what he did was made me, well, first of all, I got mad. I was like, I know it's not working. I'm the one over backing up third. And so I then went off the back of the mound, still hot under the collar. And I said, so what are you doing? He said, well, you're throwing first pitch fastball and they're jumping on every one of them. And it threw 17 breaking balls in a row, got out of the inning, and then wound up throwing 7 shutout innings from that point on and lost 4-3. But the point of that is, you see, that he knew he had to engage my mind. You got to start thinking out here. You've got to change something. And sometimes he would just come out and jump on me about something. But it was just such a great relationship. And he knew me so well that he knew what to say when he came out. It was always great.
So as an older Don Carmen who now speaks to other athletes, do you often go back to that experience and other experiences that you had as the young Don Carmen to kind of figure out how to get people past that moment of fear, that moment of concern?
Absolutely. It was one of the things that, you know, and whether it be a moment like that or even the night before, because I can relate to them, like when you're struggling or if you've got something that's not working for you, it's the last thing you think about before you go to sleep. And it's the first thing that pops into your head. And the next day. So what I do is I put them in those places. I want you to be there in your hotel room, because I tell them, I say, I know what you do. You stand in front of the mirror and work on your delivery. I know what you do. And you think about it all the time. And then you watch somebody else's delivery and you try something that they're doing. And when I show them that I know what they're going through, they learn to trust that I know what I'm talking about. But then I got to, you know, the next step is to be able to give them coping skills for these things and to understand what to do when the anxiety hits, because it's coming, because it's part of what competitors deal with. It's the most prolific issue in all of professional baseball, and I imagine most sports, but definitely baseball.
You talk about athletes dealing with anxiety. Jeff and I are Ted Lasso fans. Recent episode, one of the characters got the yips. And I've heard you talk in other interviews about the yips. Like, the coaches are even afraid to say the word. We've seen it happen with other people. And we sort of saw something like that happen here in Philadelphia with Ben Simmons, who now doesn't want to go to the free throw line to the point where he's passing the ball up so he doesn't get fouled. How do you address a situation like that so that the athlete can get back to using the skills they have as opposed to thinking about what could go wrong when they try to use those skills?
The first thing that has to happen is I have to show them that I'm not afraid of it. So the tone of my voice will mean everything also. And how easily I discuss what they're going through. Because everybody else is, I mean, they're going to give them physical things, do this, and they've tried all of these. And I tell them, I know what you've tried. You've tried, maybe I'll tuck, you know, and I'm now talking about Ben, maybe you've tried tucking your elbow under a little more, or maybe put it out a little wider, or maybe throw, you know, a little more arc on it, or a little less, and you try all of these things, and maybe even you shuffle your feet, or, you know, anything like that, and none of them work. And they will work in practice, but they don't work under fire, because you're actually wishing it would fix itself. You're wishing it would go away. And then I let them understand, by that, they understand that I get it. And my guess is it's the last thing that he thinks about every day, and it's the first thing he thinks about in the morning. And he hopes it's not going to happen. And that hope of it not happening is debilitating.
So how do you get past it? I mean, look, I've been to practice. I've seen Ben Simmons shoot threes and free throws and do them with good form. But for whatever reason, he comes out onto the big stage and it goes away. And then when he misses that first one, as Jason pointed out, then he becomes so fearful of going to the line that it's impacting everything else that he does to the point that he doesn't want to touch the ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the things that I would bring up too, is like, okay, and you're probably thinking game on the line, if it's close or whatever, they're trying to get back in the game. You're saying, please don't throw it to me. To the point where you almost want to come out of the game. So understanding that, you know, so, and I'm kind of, it's kind of like that, you know, I'm drowning and you're describing the water, but I have to describe the water first. And then I let them know, I know we're going to get to the other side of this. I've dealt with this countless times and we always get to the other side. The only time it doesn't work is if you don't do it. So what we're going to do is to go back and look at what you're now afraid of your own fear. The fear itself or the anxiety itself is not debilitating until you're afraid of it, until you're trying to avoid it, or until you're wishing it weren't there. This is a storm you are in. You got to hold the helm, as Cyrus would say, right? Anyone can hold the helm when the seas are calm. So what you got to do is hold the helm, but you don't know how to do that because you're hoping the storm will end. But it's only going to get bigger. And it feeds on itself. That anxiety and fear feeds on itself. And the more you fight it, the stronger it becomes. So what we're going to do is look at, what is your brain really doing? It was like that's an alarm system that goes off, you know, in a simple way. It's that anxiety is an alarm system. And it's like, boom, I'm going to hear it. And now, so you look around for, what is it that I'm supposed to look at? Right? So I'm looking at I have to shoot a free throw and everybody in the nation knows that I can't do it. I'm collapsing in this situation.
We talk about everyone in the nation there and the pressure. If I switch to another athlete on the world stage and how she handled things, Simone Biles, who basically it seemed like the yips in terms of, she called it the spins, where she couldn't locate where she was. How she handled that mental health challenge, how she stepped away and came back. Can you talk about that and the pressure that was on her as a member of a team there and individually representing her country to be able to take that step back and face the challenges she had?
It's really hard for me to speak to that because I don't, I can say, if you don't have the ability or someone that can help you deal with it, then you do have to step back. And that's a difficult thing. And she's not just a part of the USA team. She is the greatest of all time. And one of the few people that there's no argument, right? In any sport, she is the greatest. So she's, her having to do that and step back, that takes a lot of courage, because she could just keep pounding away, which is what people do with the physical part of it. But if she's not prepared with the mental part, it's never going to change. And then, so with that, yes, stepping back, if you don't have the coping skills for this kind of anxiety and dealing with it, then you have to back away from it. Now, the thing with Ben is I look at it and say, first I let them know, like, you know that you can shoot. You're actually really good at it. But, and I like to put it like a simple, you know, like your brain works like, I have a thinking brain and an athletic brain, right? And the athletic brain is kind of that lizard, that brain that can, that the one that, you don't have to think about how you walk. You don't have to think about that because you learned how to do it and you do it without thinking. And when you're shooting and somebody's crawling all over you and you throw it up, you're not thinking about how to do it and you're great at it. But now I'm going to stand here with nobody on me and I have all this time, but I don't have a plan for the negative thoughts and the fear. And that's what we make a plan for. So what am I going to do with this? I'm not afraid of my fear. I'm not afraid of this storm. This is the beginning. The beginning.
Yeah, and it's amazing to hear you go through that process. And as somebody that's not a public figure has to deal with it, it's a struggle enough to face the fear and get over it. What is it like? I mean, you've been on that stage. You've been in front of tens of thousands of people, knowing millions of people are watching you in any given moment. Where we see with Naomi Osaka that she's encountered something similar. And what she's done is she's decided, okay, I'm going to take away some of those external factors by not doing press conferences and things like that. Is that an effective way for people to do it, as opposed to facing everything, to face the thing that's right in front of you and then to try to eliminate the other distractions?
I would not recommend it, because what do I do if I still feel the anxiety? I haven't really dealt with it. I'm just trying to push it aside. I'm trying to get rid of anything that creates it. But this game itself of tennis that she's playing, and now every eye is on her, and so what if this then starts to slide away? What's my new plan? Take away more and take away more. And in fact, I'm not dealing with what's really going on in my head. I'm actually trying to pretend that there is, I'm going to take these things away and hope that the anxiety goes away, rather than I'm going to learn how to deal with, how do I respond to anxiety? And this is kind of one of the, it's the biggest factor in being able to go through this is learning how to deal with anxiety. And one of the things I've dealt with a lot of players, and I had a superstar who was making $30 million a year. Well, he was probably making 15 at that time. Called me one night and said he passed out on deck from anxiety, right? And he went down on his knees, and then they got recovered enough to go to the plate and hope he didn't get hit. He said he couldn't see anything. The whole place was black. And I'd been working with him for a while with all the things that everybody talks about for working with anxiety. And those things work with small levels of anxiety, and they work really well on the sofa, but they don't work out there. I've found they don't. What would happen? And this, it just popped into my head, right? And then so what would happen if you, instead of trying to get rid of it, you took it up? Instead of, if I'm an 8 out of 10 in anxiety, what happens if I just, okay, let's just take it up. All right. And see what happens and play up here. Because my brain wants to be up here, let's do it. And then you're not, and it's not accepting anxiety. It's knowing that it's coming and you're not afraid of it because I'm going to play up there. I can play at any level I want. It's when you fight it, it becomes debilitating. That's when it gets you. I'm not telling you you're not going to get anxious because you are. And that's part of the game too, but how do I deal with it? Now, interestingly, this player and his wife thank me every time. Every time I talk to them, it's, you have absolutely changed our lives because now he's not anxious all day at home. He's not, and when the anxiety comes, there's no anger with it. It's just, let's take it up then. My brain wants to be up here, let's take it up here. Because think about what your brain is doing when you are experiencing this anxiety. It's the fight or flight, right? The old fight or flight. So what is your brain is doing is it's preparing you to be better at surviving, at fighting. So why then would it be debilitating your brain? Why would it do something that's you would think would be the opposite, that would actually be debilitating? It's not. In fact, you actually, when you're there in that state, your reflexes are faster, you process information faster, and the studies show also that you see faster, which is, well, why would we fight it? And I want to let the player know at that point, it's part of what makes you great, and you're fighting it, and the fight is what's destroying you. So let's stop fighting it. So I did that with this player, and he wound up being superstar, he was already great, but
well, now I'm gonna have to go
change his life.
Now I'm going to have to go follow the superstars and see how they're doing. Tom, we could talk to you all day about this. We got to run to a break. But seriously, thanks so much for helping raise awareness and understanding of some of what athletes go through. We really appreciate the time.
You got it. All right. All right.
Thank you so much,
Jeff. See you again. Yep.
Take it easy. Thank you, Don. Jeff, why don't we hit the break? We'll have a quick commercial when we come back. We'll have Jamie Collins talk some college football.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains. And the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm, and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.
With college football at our front door, we're joined by Jamie Morris, co-host of the M Zone on 1050 The Ticket in Michigan. Jamie, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How you guys doing?
We're doing great. The college football is here. What more can we ask? And people are actually at the stadium. You know, for somebody who for years got to experience 110,000 people at Michigan cheering you on and then in the pros, what was it like for you to observe football games with no fans? And now what do you think the players are going through experiencing the fans coming back?
Well, it's a two-prong. So for the young guys that came in as freshmen to play for the University of Michigan and have an opportunity to play in front of the largest crowd in college football today, they didn't get a chance to experience it. For the guys that had experienced it, it was probably a letdown for them because they're so used to using that crowd as a pick me up. Not that they needed a pick me up, but I mean, it is the greatest thrill of your life coming out of Michigan football tunnel, running onto the field and hearing in unison the victors being sang. And you just sit, you observe that. It is the most incredible feeling that you could ever have.
You know, I'm a Rutgers boy, so I have to deal with Jeff singing that song a lot. So just letting you know, I deal with that. But, you know, you talk about the feeling of running out on a tunnel or being in that stadium. At this time of year, things getting ready to kick off. I know you're in the middle of it with your own radio show. Do you miss being on the field?
You know, I get that question a lot. If you ask me that probably 10, 15 years ago, sure, I do. But now I'm okay. I think that I've had my time in the sun. You know what I'm saying? I've had my opportunity. I got a chance to play for one of the greatest college football coaches in the history of college football. I had a chance to play with the biggest guys that I've ever witnessed. And, you know, it was just I have to look at my 4 years and I'll compare them to anybody's for any college. And, you know, it's second to none. So, no, I don't miss it. Do I wish I could go back and play it again? Sure. But, I you know, hopefully I could correct the mistakes that I did along the way.
Well, so, Jamie, you may not miss it. But so one of the reasons we wanted to have you on was to talk about going back in a time machine. And what would you have done, or how different would college football be for people like you who did have the recognition, playing at a big school, being the MVP of a bowl game, going to the pros later on? What would it have been like for you in the name, image, and likeness realm? And how would it have changed, if anyway, how would it have changed what decisions you made with regard to where you went to school and how different your experience would have been at school?
I grew up loving the University of Michigan since I was 8 years old. So I don't think I would have chose any other school with the NIL. But I will tell you that it would have been different because, you know, I'm a team player. I'm that kind of guy. I got there. I got there and I was 142 pounds. If you can believe that, I was in the best shape of my life. I was coming off a track. I had gotten an invitation to the Olympic trials in 1984. And, I thought I was a stud, but when I got to the University of Michigan, slowly but surely did I lose all of that confidence, because you're looking at guys that are 6'2" playing running back that can run just as fast as me and different things like that. But I had an opportunity. You know, you hear the expression, take advantage of all your opportunities. I had a high IQ to play football. I understood the plays, and I had three brothers that came before me. I was fortunate. I had three brothers that came before me that went on to play college football at the University of Syracuse, and they taught me a lot. They taught me the basics of football. It's really the terminology you need to learn, because football has the same plays. They just call it something different, and you just need to learn the terminology. And I used that information that they gave me, and I got a chance to catch up with the veteran players. So getting an opportunity and becoming a named person, but I would have made sure that the five guys in front of me, the three guys on the outside of me, wide receivers, I'd made sure that my teammates enjoyed making money just as I could. The danger of this, it's a great opportunity, and it's about time that something like this happened. But the danger of this is the quarterback, the running back, the wide receiver, maybe the tight end. But everybody forgets the big uglies in front of you. You can't forget those guys because they are the most important part of college football on an offense. If they're not doing their job, none of the other guys could do their job.
And you were a team leader, and you talk about the other players on the team. There's been some suggestion, including by coaches like Nick Saban, that this could create issues in the locker room between the haves and the have-nots. As someone who held that locker room leader role, how would you address those types of situations?
Well, I would bring up the idea of pooling money. I mean, and then distribute it out, making sure everybody gets a piece of the pie. Now, I mean, I'm not saying that if you're making $1 million, an example, if you're making $1 million, you don't need to make $1 million. You can make $750, and that, if you're in college, if you get $300,000, $350 into the pot, you're still helping your fellow teammates. You're making them happy. I mean, that's a lot of money, and it's just that you need to make sure everybody, as Coach would say, everybody's got to eat, so everybody gets a piece of that pie. And I would advocate for that. We had committees on our football team where it's always the seniors, juniors, sophomores, and freshmen. So we would make sure everybody had a piece, including all the way down to the managers. You got to make sure everybody's part of the team. So I mean, it is the most important thing you need to do is make sure everybody, because these are your brothers. These are the guys that got beside you when you had to do those early runs in the morning, when you had to sprint, they don't do two-a-days anymore, but when we had those two-a-days, maybe sometimes three-a-days in 90-degree weather. And that's how a team is built over the summertime.
But Jamie, that sounds great, and that's what a leader does, and that's what a team player does, is what you're suggesting. But what you can't mandate it. So I'm just going to use a quarterback. What happens if a quarterback comes in and he gets $1.5 million and his parents and his family say, no, we're not sharing it? How do you deal with it? I mean, these are the practical problems that we're going to have now. I think it's a great idea to have the NIL. The question is how do you keep the locker room together in these situations?
Well, he's just got to get, if he wants to be part of the team. I mean, look, When you choose your team, when you choose a college, when a young man or a young lady chooses a college, they're choosing to be with a team. They met these athletes when they first got there. So it's got to be bestowed upon them that when you come here, we come here, this is what we do. Mom, dad, whoever you need to tell, this is what we do here. It's not mandated. You may not want to come here because here, this is what we do. Because we love one another. We're a family here. I know you have your direct family and everything like that, but if you want to be a part of this program, this is what we do. And that's got to be explained. I this is not a hard thing. Discipline is the most important thing when it comes to college sport. If you have no discipline, then you have a bad team. So with that being said, every athlete understands what team rules are and where the team rules are. And like I said, athletes will go and go. Look, I'll tell you, Nick Saban isn't the most favorite coach. I mean, if you ask players about Nick Saban, those guys that are in the NFL, yeah, they love Coach Saban. But when they were going through the hell, they did not like Nick Saban. Trust me. But they thank him now. Just like we did. We thank Bo Schembechler for what he was, a mean cuss. Back when I was a freshman, sophomore, a junior. But I learned what he was doing my senior year. I mean, it's part of your growing up.
You know, well, you mentioned that, and I'm curious because we've sort of seen the change in college football through the years recently with the transfer portal. And a lot of that tough love is sometimes interpreted, a benching is I'm going to potentially go someplace else. Now you add name, image, and likeness on top of it. How do you think this is all going to impact with student athletes trying to move around to what they view as the best opportunity for themselves, which may not be the best opportunity for the team that they've originally chosen?
Well, look, the best thing that happened was the transfer portal. And I, you know what? I'm a fan of that too. I get it. I understand. The kids, you're 18 years of age, 17, 18 years of age, making one of the most important decisions in your life. And you know what? You could go up, you could go to that college, have a great time. Two days of official visits cannot make 4 years. You've got to do your own homework too. See, that's what people think. These kids go on these official visits, come back and say, "Oh my God, they have golden sidewalks, and they got this, they got that, they got this." And yes, they're a very passionate kids, but I did, because I knew what kind of guy I was. When I saw Michigan's locker room and everything like that, I went crazy. Oh my God! But my mother and father kept me grounded. They asked the questions about education. You got to have somebody in your family unit that is asking those tough questions, because I'm not going to ask them. I'm 17, 18 years old. All I want to see is that damn stadium. I want to go to the basketball game if it's basketball season on my visit. I want to go to the hockey game if that's my thing. I'm trying to get a feel what the fans are like and different things like that, because I'm a very impressionable little kid, young man. But my mother and father, they looked at everything. Not that they said anything. They did ask questions about education and how important it was and what happens. And they were told about the Michigan experience, and we're the largest living alumni base, blah, 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 all of that. And they were told everything. So when we came back and we did the comparisons, and we sat at the dinner table, and my parents went through it three times, because I had three brothers that went through it. So they kind of sat me down and told me what they thought, their impressions, and everything like that. And when I chose the University of Michigan, and I said, I think I want to go to Michigan, I think my mother told me, "You're my youngest. I don't want you to go. You would be better off at Boston College," because I was living in Massachusetts at the time. We lived in a little small town called Ayr. That being said, I mean, if you think about the NIL, yeah, that would have made me popular in the state of Massachusetts and different things like that. Because I thought about this. Oh, I could have cashed in and everything like that. But that's just the state of Massachusetts. If you make it at the University of Michigan, that's national recognition. You know, everybody knows you. Everybody knows Michigan. Everybody knows that fight song. Everybody knows those helmets. So, you know, you look at that. And then the other colleges, Wisconsin. I looked at Wisconsin. My mother and father loved Wisconsin because they were going to get me a job, a summer job, and they were going to do this and they were going to do that. And I said to them, it's not recognized like the University of Michigan. Nothing against Wisconsin, but I'm talking national stage. So I thought in an NIL situation, I chose right. You know, I had the opportunity to play early. I had the opportunity. I kept my position as I got better and better. And as the offense got better and better, we were running the ball a lot more. I mean, I figured, and I do this, Jumbo Ellie and I talk all the time. We talk almost every day. That's my, yes. We talk about the NIL. He's like, "We could have cleaned up, Jay. Me and you, we could have cleaned up and everything." I mean, I remember this photo that I took with Jumbo, me standing on a stool and putting my shoulder on his, my arm on his shoulder. That's an iconic picture. And I said, we could have used that picture selling cars and selling toothpaste and all kinds of things.
You could have been autographing that places. You'd have made it.
Exactly.
Yeah, but Jumbo would have needed a lot more money to pay for his groceries than you did.
I'm going to tell you this. When my mom came to games, well, she didn't really go to the game. She made food. So when my mom would come in on Friday and Saturday, and everybody, all the offensive linemen knew, because she fed them. They came over on Sunday. We had a big Sunday breakfast, and we sat around watching Michigan replay to see if the old man was going to be angry, because that's your, you know, he shoots that at night, at the Saturday night. On Sunday morning, it debuts before we go down to watch film. And he kind of gives you hints of what he's going to say to the team. So we used to watch that all the time together.
One of your other teammates is now the athletic director at the University of Michigan.
Warren Manuel. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we had him on the show when the transfer portal first started, And he talked to us about some of the pitfalls of the transfer portal. And sometimes kids not everybody who goes to college is as fortunate as you in that you had a good family, that you had brothers that had already gone through it, including Joe, who played for the Giants. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have a lot of these people that are hangers on, and then the dreaded boosters, which isn't always a bad word, but sometimes it can be, and they don't have the best interests of these young, you know, athletes in their minds. So when you have something like the NIL, in addition to that, and you see what's going on at places like Miami, where somebody gave money to the entire team.
Yeah.
What do you do as an athletic director to somehow control this and make sure that it doesn't get out of control? Because right now it's the Wild West. There are no rules for any of this.
Exactly. The worst thing that happened is that the athletic directors took a back seat. They didn't get involved. And I'm not dogging out my guy Ward, but his whole profession. I mean, they all sat back and watched. And maybe they couldn't do anything. Maybe the university didn't want them to do anything. But you got to get involved. These kids need guidance, leadership. And what they did is a damn shame. Shame on them for what they did. Because it is the Wild West now. And what they'll get, they will reap the rewards of what these kids can do now. I'm sorry. They shouldn't have let these kids, you know, come out until they had rules and regulations. You can always change rules and regulations as you both know. But if things are established now, you're gonna go to court. Kids can take now these young people can take universities to court and say, hey, we did it when we first came out, and this is we didn't have a problem with this, and why do they have a problem with this? And they're gonna basically win. Because you had no regulations or rules before this came out. You just said, hey, like you said, have at it, boys. Go take care of it. You got this is we've got NIL now. Go do what you do. Bring it to us. And guess what? We'll take a look at it. We're pretty much going to sign you through as long as it's not alcohol, gambling, or pornography. I mean, really?
And that seems to be the guidelines. As long as it's not one of those three things, it's like, all right, go ahead.
Well, that's an NFL thing. That's a basketball. That's an NBA thing. That's basic. I mean, they just took the basics and said, okay, you can't do this. But they have done something. The University of Michigan has said you have to come to us and pay us for a license fee to use the Block M. So kids can't use the Block M. But I play for Michigan, but I can't use the Block M, but you have to pay for that Block M. You have to do like any other vendor that wants to use that Block M, you have to pay for it. Doesn't seem fair though. And they'll argue that too. I play for you. I mean, come on.
Sure, I was going to say, I'm sure that they'll argue that they're on the field playing for it. Why can't they use the photo that they took? But I did want to ask you sort of about the larger issue of the NCAA sort of leading from behind as usual. You know, you have the NIL issue, you have realignment now with Texas and Oklahoma going to the SEC, the Pac-12, Big Ten, and ACC with a handshake, the Big 12 is looking for more people. And apparently the whole thing's thrown the college playoff expansion into doubt. Your thoughts on the overall state of college football right now?
Well, like you said, the NCAA is doing its usual thing, leading from behind. Look, I guess having court cases and losing court cases and losing in the Supreme Court and all of those things, I guess it's true. They have a monopoly, and they've always had a monopoly, and they got exposed. So now why not go and work with these young men, young people? Why not go and allow these young people to work together? I mean, I get it, but if the NCAA and the universities in general, if you're coming to a university, universities have rules and regulations. You can't tell them what to do. I can't tell them, but student athletes can't tell them what to do. Universities can abolish sports if they want to. They don't want to because that's a lot of money. But that being said, it's the fear of it. So kids will listen to these universities. But it's like you said, they're leading from behind. They're afraid of being taken to court and losing again. And the problem is, if you're afraid, it's an antiquated system. That's what the NCAA is. You've got to lead by examples. Universities have got to come together and vote on this and vote in a good director of the NCAA, someone who understands college athletics and young people, what young people want. And you've got to have boards with young people on them. The kids have got to be able to have their say at the table. The problem is you like the money and you don't have to pay the kids. Let's be honest. This is all about money. This is all about money and who gets it. And they've had it for years where they didn't
have a... Jamie, they're amateurs. They're student athletes. Come on, we got to go along with this here.
I think that went away when we decided to have the Dream Team go out and slaughter all these teams. Remember that in 92? That yes. The amateurism went away a long time ago. And I'm sorry, we've got to get away from that. I know, I get it. I get it. They don't want to have a payroll of in excess of this and that. Look, you have a standard pay throughout the colleges. Agree with it. And you don't call it salary. You call it, what do you call it? You just call it expenditures. Or you call them, what do we used to get?
You could call it a stipend. You can call it whatever you want.
You call it whatever you want, whatever you need to call it to make it sound like to the fan base that, hey, they're playing for us. Or they're going for the blue. Yes, we're all together here. No, you get a nice stipend. You pay the stipend. Alabama plays the highest stipend in the country. Everybody knows that.
Well, look, we could probably talk all day about these issues. But the good news is there is college football, and there are
assuming the water goes down at Rutgers.
Yeah, right. So you know, before we let you go, one, how excited are you, and how optimistic? My fingers are crossed. Are you that Michigan is going to turn it around this year? And what do you see of the rest of, let's just do the Big Ten, because I'm sure that's what you focus on your show.
I'm very excited about the college football season starting. I'm excited for people going to the stadium. I'm nervous about people going to the stadium. I like that the university established a mask mandate that goes into the stadium. When you get to your seats, you can and cannot, or you don't have to, take off your mask. But if you're moving around the stadium, you have to wear a mask. I do like that. That being said, I think it's great for college football. I think college football will benefit immensely. Do I think that we're going to have 100,000 fans at every home game and things like that? I think you're going to be I get a lot of alumnus that contact me, and we text with one another and everything like that. I think we're going to have probably between 80 to 85,000 people. It will be announced that we had 100,000, over 100,000 fans in the stadium. But I don't.
Well, the band counts. Remember.
I know the band counts. The players that don't play, the vendors that are making your hot dogs and hamburgers. Anybody.
Jeff watching at home on his couch. That counts too.
I'm excited for the Big Ten, and in answer to your question about the University of Michigan, I think we needed to make a turn. And Jim Harbaugh, who was my quarterback for 3 years, I mean, I think he got his mind right. I think he brought in a very aggressive staff, a younger staff, someone that got him fired up again. And he doesn't have a bunch of yes men behind him anymore. And I'm sorry, that's just my opinion, but look, we need go-getters. We need guys that want to be head coaches someday, and they're going to get into these kids, and they're not going to be nice guys about it. They're going to tell you what they need, and if you don't deliver, we'll replace you and put the next player in. And that's what you want. And that's what they need. So I think Michigan's going to be a big surprise. A lot of people are not as excited as I am, but I think you'll get a lot of surprise games. They're either going to beat Penn State or they're going to beat Wisconsin. I'd like them to beat both, but I see an 8-4, 9-3 team. They could get the 9 if they play their butts off, but they're going to have to play.
The real question is, can they beat the Big Ten powerhouse Rutgers? That's the real question.
Well,
Jeff loves when I try to push Rutgers. Is like
yeah, I was Jamie. Situation. I was at the 77 nothing game. So
Jamie, not only was he at the 77 nothing game, he was texting me at every score to remind me that they had scored again. So not only did I get the ESPN alert, I got Jeff's text to let me know how few fans were in the stadium and how many points Michigan had put up. It was great.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I think John Runyon gave you some crap about that afterwards too.
That day, by himself.
Yeah, story of my life as a Rutgers fan, but we're hoping for better this year, Jamie.
And you will get better. I think Greg Schiano's got them pointing in the right direction. He's hungry. We know he knows how to recruit. So I think he does a good job, and I think everybody will be impressed with what he's done.
See, well, Jeff, I have to leave it there. It's a positive note about Rutgers to end the show with two Michigan men.
Yeah, and Jamie, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about college football and all that's going on at the beginning of the season. You can catch Jamie as co-host of the M Zone on 1050 The Ticket in Michigan. Jamie, good luck and go blue.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Jamie, we got a guest on, Jeff, that said good things about Rutgers. I should just stop the show now forever, right?
He was just being kind.
He was humoring me. Yeah. I know you think he's a little Pollyannish in the...
No. That's your word. I don't use that
word. My word of describing it, but you don't believe that players would necessarily buy into giving a portion of their name, image, and likeness money.
No, it's a team sport. He's very old school. Which is not a bad thing. I mean, some people say go old school in a bad way. I say old school in a good way because I'm old. I know. I'm not even letting you take that shot. But I don't think it's practical in some situations. You have people you've now heard getting $1 million plus before they ever step on campus. Do you think that the older players that are already at the university are going to contact this kid and say, hey, by the way, we're putting it all of the money you're getting or part of it in a pot for other people, and that the parents and the people that are advising that kid are going to say, yeah, sure, okay. It may work for people when they're there and are teammates. That's not going to happen. There's no way.
30 seconds, fun conversations with both he and Don Carmen, completely mm-hmm. different angles, but eye-opening conversations.
Don was so compelling. It really was. I mean, it opened my eyes as to how you deal with these. And there was so much more to ask him about.
Well, we'll talk about it more next week when we come back. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Discover spirituality for everyday living with Religion and Inspiration with Cantor Scott Borsky. Celebrant, educator, chaplain, and speaker, Cantor Scott Borsky will open your eyes to the joy and meaning in our everyday lives with a generous dose of good humor. Cantor Borsky can help everyone discover inspiration in the everyday moments of their religion, background, tradition, and beliefs. It's 30 minutes well spent. Religion and Inspiration with Cantor Scott Borsky, Sunday mornings at 7:30 on WWDB.
Be sure to catch Dining on a Dime, a total foodie show, right here, 6 p.m. Tuesdays. Chef
Gene Blum, I be foodie too, culinary educator.
Amaris Pollock, I'm the food photojournalist.
Matt Maritea, doing booze and brews.
Every Tuesday, 6 p.m. drive time, Dining on a Dime.
Dining on a Dime.